That's a hot band from about 1570 or 75, playing William Byrd's My Lord of Oxenford's what? Is it Pavane? No. I can't read my own writing.
Galliard?
Galliard. It's My Lord of Oxenford's Galliard, which I am informed is more or less representative Elizabethan music. Does it sound that way to you, Carol Levin, after I tell everybody that you are here, that you're a professor of history at the University of Nebraska in Lincoln, and the chief historical consultant at the Newberry Library's exhibit on Elizabeth I. Just as I inform everybody else that, or everybody also, rather, that Robert Buchholz, an old friend of ours, is also a specialist in this period in English history and is professor of history at Loyola University, Chicago. What was I asking you before I stopped?
You were asking me about the Galliard, and yeah. I would say that the Galliard sounded great to me. Elizabeth I loved to dance. It was one of her favorite things to do, and so she would adore the Galliard.
I've been looking at some of the books I have before me, and a number of them are by Carol Levin. Let me see. One is titled The Reign of Elizabeth I. It's pretty clear what that one's about, and I've been reading that one today. Another is The Heart and Stomach of a King, Elizabeth I and the Politics of Sex and Power. Now, that title needs explanation. It comes from one of her speeches, does it not?
Elizabeth I went down to Tilbury in 1588. The Spanish were planning to invade England, and her council told her to stay and stay safe in England, and she didn't do it. She went down to Tilbury, and she said, "My loving people, I have always so behaved myself that under God I have placed my chiefest strength and safeguard in the loyal hearts and goodwill of my subjects, and therefore I am comest among you, as you see at this time being resolved, in the midst and heat of battle, to lay down for my God and my kingdom and my people, my honor and my blood, even in the dust. I know I have the body of a weak and feeble woman, but I have the heart and stomach of a king, and a king of England too, and think foul scorn that Parma or Spain or any prince of Europe should dare invade the borders of my realm."
This is as they're about to go out and face the Armada, isn't it?
That's right. It's a great moment, and like many great moments in politics, it's a bit of a sham, because if the Spanish army had actually landed, I suspect that there's no way that this ragtag band of farmers with sticks would have been able to resist the Duke of Parma's the greatest army in Europe. But of course, it was part of Elizabeth's genius to be able to capture a moment like that, to know exactly what to say to her people, and to give the sense that she shared their fate. Would she have done so? Would she have actually gone into the front lines? We'll never know.
There are great actors in history, and of course they transform the course of history. If they weren't there, everything would have turned out very differently, and we probably wouldn't be sitting here tonight. If Elizabeth had, in fact, been executed, as for a while some people wanted to do to her when she was just a young woman living in semi-imprisonment.
That's correct.
If there had been no Elizabeth I, what would be different in the world?
Well, England might not have been Protestant. I mean, imagine that along with this, perhaps Mary lives, England remains Catholic. Then a lot of the impetus for colonization of the United States goes away. You wouldn't have had Puritans, because there would have been nothing to purify and nothing to get away from. I think an awful lot of our political and legal tradition, I've often made the point and try to make in my own work, that the United States Constitution is really in many ways an English history lesson. That history would have been fundamentally different, knowing the Civil War, probably, I suspect, a less powerful parliament, maybe not the evolution of a constitutional monarchy. So it would indeed have been a very different world.
And a very different United States, too, as Bob is suggesting. Elizabeth showed incredible courage, in fact, during that time when she was imprisoned in the Tower of London and afraid that she might be executed. And her courage during that time was something that I think we really are impressed by. And for Elizabeth, it was because she really believed in a Protestant God that was saving her to save England. And in the same way, the English were convinced that God was an Englishman, and that's why the winds scattered the Spanish, and they never landed, and England was saved from the Armada as well.
Of course, if Henry VIII, her father, had conceived a son with his first wife, all of history would have been quite different anyway.
Absolutely.
And there would have been no Elizabeth I, because he never would have married Anne Boleyn, I suppose.
That's right. Henry VIII's first wife, Catherine of Aragon, the youngest daughter of Ferdinand and Isabella of Spain, was in many ways an absolutely terrific wife to Henry. She was very brave, she was loyal, she was highly educated. But the most important thing from Henry's point of view for a queen was having a living son, and unfortunately for Catherine, none of her children except her daughter Mary survived infancy. So Henry broke with the Catholic Church, turned his world upside down to marry Anne Boleyn, and then to his great chagrin, had another daughter. Anne lasted less than 3 more years, and the very day of her execution in 1536, she was executed on charges of adultery and treason. Henry announced his engagement to his next wife, another lady-in-waiting, Jane Seymour, and it was Jane who gave Henry the son he craved. But again, luckily for Elizabeth, young Edward was very sickly and died when he was only 15 years old after 6 years of rule.
And if you go down to the exhibit at the Newbury Library, Elizabeth, Ruler and Legend, you can actually see the birth announcement for young Princess Elizabeth, and it's very clear that the original, I think it's a Privy Seal, says Prince. And what they've done is they've added an S or two
exactly.
at the end.
And in fact, what Henry had done, he was so sure it was going to be a son, he had these all written out ahead of time, and rather than have them rewritten, they just squeezed in a few S's. And as Bob has suggested, the Newbury Library's exhibit, Elizabeth I, Ruler and Legend, is an incredible exhibit. It's up until January 17th, and it has about 70% of the items are from the Newbury Library. We also have amazing loans from the British Library, so people should definitely come and see it.
What was the Elizabethan age? What is distinctive about the way that things changed and the kind of culture that arose and the pattern of dynamic, excited political life? In general, we think of the Elizabethan age as the great event of the Renaissance in England. But what was that life like? In fact, take us, if you will, Bob, and you've done this before, take us to London.
All right.
What's a good year to aim for?
Oh, well, let's see. I think we might want to do maybe around the time of the Armada of 1588, maybe
right.
a little later, 1590s, because by this time the public theaters are erected on the south bank of the Thames, and you can see the earliest plays of Shakespeare and other great dramatists. The place is dirty, smelly, overcrowded. London is growing by leaps and bounds. Something like 6,000 people a year come to London by 1600. It's a boom town. It's much more like San Francisco, 1858.
1588, you say. How many people are living there?
Oh, let's see. I would say probably about 100,000, maybe 150,000 off the top of my head. But that's going to grow. In 100 years, it'll be 500,000. So it's growing at a very rapid pace. The area within the walls of London, within the old city walls, roughly the area from St. Paul's Cathedral to the Tower of London, is just about a square mile. And yet, something like 100,000 people cram themselves in there, at least during the day, for business. The buildings are made of wood and plaster. They fall down all the time. The noise is deafening. Street criers, hawkers. It must have been an assault on the senses to anyone who came from a little English village of maybe 100, 200 people to come to London. It would have changed your life. Now, a little bit downriver, and the river itself would not have been too salubrious, but it would have been, as we saw in Shakespeare in Love, the only way, or the best way to get around. You would have taken a boat upriver to the west end, where you would have found the Palace of Whitehall. And that's where we would find the Queen and her council and Parliament. And that, of course, was the great center of everything that mattered in England. I work on the court, so I'm fond of telling students, don't just think of the White House or Capitol Hill. Think of the White House, Capitol Hill, Hollywood, Bloomsbury, the Round Table, the Algonquin Hotel, and People magazine, all wrapped up into one place.
The Round Table of the Algonquin Hotel?
That was a group of
writers and artists in the 1920s in
that's
a famous
right.
hotel in New York.
That's right, and famous for scintillating wit.
Yeah, right.
And conversation, Dorothy Parker, people like this. And, of course, you had that at the Elizabethan court.
Mm-hmm.
People.
Who was the Robert Benchley of the Elizabethan court?
Oh, gosh.
Or the Alexander Wolcott. They were other members of the Round Table.
What do you think? I mean, you've got Shakespeare, but in some ways a fairly minor figure at court. You have Elizabeth's treasurer, Lord Burghley.
You have Sir Francis Walsingham, who kept her safe. He was the spy master, and there were many attacks.
He was the Wild Bill Donovan of Elizabethan times.
Well, in some ways, and there were all these plots and conspiracies to have Elizabeth assassinated and put Mary Stuart on the throne, and Walsingham was on top of all of them and kept Elizabeth safe. You had her favorite, Robert Dudley, who was probably the closest to a real intimate she ever had. It was a wonderful place.
Now, Virginia, the American state, is named, it was Sir Walter Raleigh, I believe, or as they say, Raleigh, don't
yes.
they? Who gave it that name, and it's for the Virgin Queen, as she was known. To be simple and direct, after all, it's an interesting, if slightly salacious, aspect of the history. Was she or was she not?
Oh, this is actually, we go back and forth about this.
That was a matter of speculation during all of those Elizabethan times, wasn't it?
I think Carol will agree with me. I think most historians would say, I would say, she couldn't have afforded the consequences of losing her virginity. Now, there is a bit of, there may be a bit of the Clinton definition of what constitutes virginity here. I think we, the evidence suggests that she was a, I think psychologists of another generation say, a normally sexed woman with the desires that would accompany that. But at the same time, remember that a pregnancy out of wedlock would have erased her legitimacy, would have cost her throne and possibly her life. Remember, too, how Catholic Europe viewed her, and I'm talking about the two most powerful countries in Europe, Spain and France, as the heretic bastard daughter of that whore Anne Boleyn. The last thing Elizabeth needs is to add to this reputation with the world by conceiving out of wedlock. So I don't...
Yet aren't there some men around court who are whispering, actually, I've been very close to the Queen?
Well, there certainly were men who were close to the Queen, but I think Bob is absolutely right. I think that Elizabeth did have emotional, certainly affectionate relationships, but I think she never would have risked a pregnancy. Interestingly enough, however, there were many people, not only on continental Europe, but people in her own country who claimed that Elizabeth had illegitimate children. And we have records of people who were arrested for slandering the Queen, for talking about she had this child, she had that child. One man said, I know the real reason she goes on Progress. She leaves court in the summer and travels. It's to get rid of her children, five all told. So there are all sorts of rumors about Elizabeth. But I think when she said in 1559, I will live and die a virgin, I think she meant it, and I think she did. But there are all kinds of ways to be a virgin, and I think that does not mean that Elizabeth was a cold woman or did not have strong emotional ties.
To whom was she emotionally tied? I know of the Earl of Essex. That's late in her career.
That's late in her career. She was very close to Robert Dudley. He was the son of the Duke of Northumberland, and he'd known Elizabeth since she was 8 years old, and he says, as an adult, she told me when she was 8 years old, she would never marry. Now, this didn't keep Robert from trying to get Elizabeth to marry him, but it was an uphill battle. One of the things that made it very difficult for him was, unfortunately from his point of view, he was already married when Elizabeth became queen in 1558. He had married at the young age of 17, a passionate love affair with a young woman named Amy Robsart. Amy was left in the country while Robert was at court with Elizabeth, and Amy was suffering from breast cancer. People said that he was just waiting for Amy to die so he could marry the Queen. But then, September 8th, 1560, instead of dying peaceably in her bed, Amy Robsart was found at the bottom of some stairs in the house in which she was living with her neck broken. Was she murdered? Was it an accident? Was it suicide? No one was ever sure. But the scandal was such that Elizabeth would never marry Robert, though he stayed her close friend until his death 20 years later.
When you read Saint-Simon about the court of Louis XIV, you get a sense that everything revolves around the king.
That's right.
All the gossip is about who he's sleeping with, who he favors, what he had for breakfast, and how you can get closer to him, and how much money you have to spend to get the proper livery to be invited to court and to stay at court. Is it similar across the channel in England?
Yeah, it is. I mean, remember that this is an age of personal monarchy in which what the monarch thinks and what the monarch does goes. And so, yeah, that now sometimes people were overly simplistic about that. They thought that, well, if you got the right person into a relationship with Elizabeth, then we could control Elizabeth. There's a funny kind of combination of, on the one hand, overestimating the power of what the king can do, but underestimating the ability of the king to, or the queen, to discriminate about advice. But remember that the broader context of all of this is something that historians call the great chain of being, the belief that all human beings are arranged in a hierarchy. Indeed, all creatures are arranged in a hierarchy devised by God, and at the top of that hierarchy is God, and that the king or queen deputizes for God and is God's lieutenant on earth. Well, once you accept that, well, of course, the king becomes, or the queen becomes, the center of attention. My favorite, it's a different quote, my favorite example of Louis XIV that I love to tell my students is the anecdote that I think is in Saint-Simon, that at chapel services, the entire court would face Louis at the back of the chapel while he faced the altar, because, of course, all of their prayers went through him.
These are fascinating people, fascinating times. A great question about Elizabeth is on her political life and how she managed to make herself an enigmatic, charismatic, but very beloved figure, and how she used the arts of that time and the costuming and the music and the pageants that went with life at the royal court, and how she made herself both available and strangely withdrawn. She really knows how to keep herself mysterious and thus especially attractive. In a way, you get the sense that she knows, even long before it was propounded, the great showbiz axiom, leave them wanting more.
That's right.
When we return, I want to hear from you something about the nature of her political art. And we will return directly to Carol Levin and to Robert Buchholz and to Elizabeth I after these words. And we return to two living Elizabethans. That is, they live in Elizabethan times because they are scholars of that period, both professors of history. Carol Levin, professor of history at the University of Nebraska, Lincoln, and chief historical consultant for the Newberry Library exhibit on Elizabeth I. And Robert Buchholz, professor of history at Loyola University. And I've got an interesting email here, long before we invited them, from a history teacher over in Michigan, who says some flattering things about the program and apparently has turned some of his students onto the program. And then he poses a question, which he says he will also pose to his students tomorrow. And here is the question. In her last speech to Parliament, Elizabeth said, "There will never queen sit in my seat with more zeal for my country." King Louis XIV is attributed with the saying, "I am the state." L'état, c'est moi, right? In the era of absolutist rule in Western Europe, who was a more effective absolutist monarch, Elizabeth the First or Louis the XIV?
Well, I would say Elizabeth the First, definitely. And I thought it might be useful to read a little bit more of that speech. This is from 1601. She said, "Though God hath raised me high, yet this I count the glory of my crown, that I have reigned with your loves. I do not so much rejoice that God hath made me to be a queen, as to be a queen over so thankful a people. There will never be queen sit in my seat with more zeal to my country, care for my subjects, and that sooner with willingness will venture her life for your good and safety than myself. For it is not my desire to live nor reign longer than my life shall reign, shall be your good. And though you have had, and may have, many princes more mighty and wise sitting in the state, yet you never had or ever shall have more caring and loving." And I think that's true. Elizabeth really did love her people and wanted the best for them. And Louis XIV was most interested, I think, in the glory, in expanding the boundaries of France. And the wars as a result were horrific to the French people. Elizabeth did not want to go to war and tried to keep her people at peace and cared much more, I think, about the actual people.
You say she loved her people. Did the people return it? How popular was she as a queen during her long reign?
She was clearly very popular, but she was careful to go to places where that popularity would be in evidence. That is to say, most of her progresses are in and around the London area, where she was definitely
progresses
popular.
Are processions.
Processions, extended junkets. I mean, you would stay the night at a peer's house and probably drain his finances so that you wouldn't have to pay for feeding the court yourself. She didn't progress in the north of England, which was heavily Catholic. That might not, we might have different testimony about that.
You might
that.
Get bad press up there.
In fact, that speech, again, forgive me for being the ghost at the feast, but the speech is a bit of a sham, too. You know, she constantly told people that they loved her. By the 1590s, they were sick of high taxation. There were riots outside of Parliament. And the issue around which the speech revolves is the granting of monopolies. She would grant monopolies on certain products to her courtiers as a way to reward them without having to raise taxes. Well, what this meant is if you held the monopoly on nails, you're Sir Walter Raleigh, then you would pass on the cost of your monopoly onto the consumer. So people were upset. So what does she do? Instead of saying, I'll deal with monopolies, I won't deal with them, she gives this great speech and she reminds them of how much they love her and how together we face down Spain. And in the middle of the speech at one point, the members of the House of Commons are kneeling. And she says, oh, Mr. Speaker, please have them rise. You know, and she talks about not being that smart, not being that wise. Well, remember that by the end of the speech, she's been ruling England now for close on to half a century. This is the only queen anybody in the House of Commons can remember. And she's reminding them of how old she is. She doesn't have long to live. I bet half the House of Commons was in tears. And I'll bet they're all in their carriage on the way home, you know, to the constituency before they realize, you know what? We never did get in that legislation about monopolies.
It was one of her answerless answers, Bob.
Right.
But I would add, she did deal with monopolies. There were at least some reforms. And while people may have felt at the time, oh, we've had this woman for so long, within a very few years of her death, when Mary Stuart's son, James I, who had been the King of Scotland, within a couple of years, people were saying, where is good Queen Bess when we need her?
That's true. She was a lot more popular in the 17th century than she was in the 1590s. But she was mostly popular during her reign. There's this bit at the end when there's a sense of she's been around too long. The war had gone on for 15 years, and it had become a stalemate.
The war with Spain.
The war with Spain. We remember the Armada victory, but in fact it dragged on. Ireland turned into England's Vietnam, mm-hmm. With, in some ways, very similar consequences. And there was a sense the country was sort of ready to move on. Well, they did. They got James I from Scotland, and for a variety of reasons, they soon regretted the move and would look back with very fond memories on Queen Elizabeth.
A book that was widely read in England by that time, I do believe, was Machiavelli's Prince. Is that right?
That's correct.
Propounded, of course, written in Florence about 100 years earlier, and designed to tell monarchs how to maintain their power and to use it wisely, which means sometimes cruelly, and how to dissemble so as to persuade and maintain and hold the mass and hold the loyalty of those other empowered persons who surround you in your ducal or your royal court. Did she know Machiavelli? Does she represent the Machiavellian wisdom, or does she have some other secrets about how to rule?
I think she certainly had other secrets. Certainly Machiavelli was very well known. We see references to Machiavelli in Shakespeare.
The evil Machiavelli.
The evil Machiavelli. But Elizabeth really did rule, I think, by convincing people that she loved them and that they should love her. Her godson, Sir John Harrington, said her smile was like sunshine, and we loved her because we knew she loved us. She did go on progress, and she would listen with a patient smile to these must have been terrible entertainments that the people of Norwich put on for her. And people would throng to her. They would beg her to touch them, that her very touch would cure them of disease. On Maundy Thursday, the Thursday before Easter, she would wash the feet of poor women. And again, they were thronged to have the queen do this. So I think instead of being a Machiavelli who used fear, though that was certainly part of her skills, she also used mercy. William Cecil, her principal secretary, was often very concerned that the queen was too merciful and that this would be a problem for England as a result. So I think she talked about having the body of a weak and feeble woman and the heart and stomach of a king. I think she used both male and female skills to rule extremely well.
She certainly, though she in the end, was forced to execute a fair number of people. I'm going to put it at around 300. It's very clear that she was reluctant about this, that she would lose. There's the famous story about the Duke of Norfolk's execution in the early 1570s, and she wakes up in the middle of the night and she writes to Secretary Cecil and says, "Cancel the warrant. You know, I can't sleep on this." Mary Queen of Scots. They went back and forth. They had clear proof that Mary Queen of Scots had authorized the murder of Queen Elizabeth, and still Elizabeth did not want to have her killed. And in the end, it could be argued Elizabeth never actually made up her mind, the famous story being that she signed a death warrant, hands it to Secretary Davison, and then doesn't tell him to use it. Davison goes back and forth to the council. What do I do? What do I do? This is what we've wanted. Mary Queen of Scots represents the Catholic alternative to Elizabeth. As long as she lives, Elizabeth's life is in danger. Finally, the council decides, all right, we'll act on it. We'll execute Mary Queen of Scots. When Elizabeth heard, she flew into a rage, gave Mary Queen of Scots a state funeral, sacked Davison, but did pay his pension for the rest of his life. So she was very conflicted about the degree of violence that a monarch had to use in those days to maintain power. And I think that degree of being conflicted is probably to her credit.
Well, though she was then a very popular queen in terms of popular support in the first 30 or so years of her reign,
yes, she
at
was.
Least,
yes.
There many people were plotting to knock her over.
That was because Elizabeth was a Protestant queen, and there were Catholics who felt that she was a heretic, that she had no right to rule, and that her cousin Mary Stuart should be queen. When Elizabeth,
would it be fair to say that the history of England for the 100 years following the Henry VIII's abandonment of the Catholic Church and the foundation of the new Anglican Church, would it be fair to say that the basic issue in English life for 100 years was between Catholicism and Protestantism?
It was certainly one of the major issues. And for Elizabeth, when she became queen in 1558, I think some of the Catholics, because her sister Mary had been a Catholic and had restored England to its obedience to Rome.
And did it with some cruelty. She was known as Bloody Mary, wasn't she?
Yes, she was. She had 300 Protestants burned in the last 3 years of her reign. And most of these were poor people who had no political power. When Elizabeth became queen, I think some Catholics were really afraid it was payback time, but Elizabeth really attempted a broadly based religious settlement. While she was a Protestant, she believed in outward conformity. She said, "I do not want to make windows into men's souls." And for the first decade, she did not persecute Catholics. The first Catholic to be executed under Elizabeth was not until the 1570s. But the situation changed drastically when her cousin Mary Stuart fled Scotland for England in 1568. Mary had been Queen of Scotland, and Mary is a disaster as queen compared to Elizabeth. Mary was forced to abdicate, was imprisoned, and managed to escape, fled to England, and then became the Catholic alternative. And there were a number of attempts by Catholics to have Elizabeth assassinated. Philip II of Spain also sent Jesuits into England to try to bring England back to the Catholic Church. So for Elizabeth, eventually the intersection of politics and religion was so intense that there was nothing she could
do. And speaking of Jesuits, that does bring to mind the gunpowder plot, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. Just a few years after Elizabeth's death, in 1605, this is after Elizabeth,
the
James
plot
I
against James.
To the throne. And what happens is James comes south from Scotland. He had ruled Scotland for several decades very effectively, but he'd given the impression that he was very tolerant in matters of religion, which he was personally. He came south and made certain promises to Catholic peers that he would lighten their burden, that he would ease their situation. And in the end, for political reasons, in part because Puritans were quite powerful within both the church and the state, he couldn't do it, or he felt he couldn't do it. Well, this bred tremendous resentment, and a group of young Catholic aristocratic hotheads thought that the way to convince people in England to become Catholic was to blow up the king and the House of Lords. I've never quite understood the logic myself, but what they do is in November of 1605, as Parliament is about to meet for the state opening, so you'd have the whole court there, you'd have the entire ruling class of England in one place, they were able to rent the basement of the House of Lords, which is an astonishing thought that you could like rent the basement of the Capitol and store.
And they packed barrels of gunpowder.
They packed it with barrels of gunpowder. It was only because one of the plotters was worried that one of his relatives was going to be killed, that he contacted that relative. The relative, in turn, went to the Privy Council, because if he had not, this would have been misprision of treason. If you know about treason, you have to. They do a midnight search, and they catch Guy Fawkes red-handed with the barrels of gunpowder, ready to do this thing. Well, even though it was a small group of Catholics who would have been repudiated by the vast majority, who were themselves, by 1603, a very small group in
England.
Wasn't
the accusation also that there was a Jesuitical hand behind all of
this? Sure, and there were Jesuits involved. There was at least one Jesuit confessor who knew about the plot, and of course there's this great debate about, you know, did he have the responsibility of warning people about this?
We are due for some more commercials. A great and persisting theme in Shakespeare's work, not in all of it, but in many of the plays, is the nature of kingship. I think that is, in fact, a preoccupation of the time, and many writers and even theologians conjure with the question of what the nature of the special, the nature of royalty is, that it isn't merely a high political post. It is in some living and unquestionable connection with God. Kings do have some godly right to their throne, yet it is also a fact that kings are caught up in politics. And in English history, kings were toppled and have been toppled, and there were plots against Elizabeth. Shakespeare is aware of all of that, and he deals with it in some interesting ways in some of his plays. When we return, I want to take a Shakespearean scene which relates to just that issue. And we'll do that right after we pause for these words. We are talking about Elizabethan times with Carol Levin and Robert Buchholz, both of whom are historical specialists in that period, and more broadly on English early modern history. And you really, in your trade, viewed the Elizabethan period as the beginning of modern history for England.
In some ways, yes. I mean, it was a period of time. Don't forget that the Scientific Revolution is just starting to get off the ground. London's growth, the beginning of... Part of the story of the theaters is public patronage of the arts. That's a hallmark of modernity. Previously, the arts were patronized by the church and by princes. So, yes, you can certainly make...
One of the founding books for modern science is being written in London by Francis Bacon.
That's right.
Novum Organum.
That's right.
Which is the new method, the new way.
And I think there's a real sense of self and an interior sense of self, which is new in the 16th century, that people did not have previous to that. On the other hand, there still are very old beliefs about superstitions, about witchcraft. There are people who are accused of being witches and are executed for being witches throughout the 16th and into the middle of the 17th century.
In fact, it's Elizabeth who passes the first witchcraft statute.
It's not the first witchcraft statute. The first one is Henry
VIII. All right. That's right.
The Henrician one is made more severe under Elizabeth, and under James the First in 1604, it's the most severe. That is not repealed until 1738, that witchcraft statute.
Now, onto this scene comes a young fellow born in 1564, just a few years after the beginning of Elizabeth's reign. But by the time he's 25, he's in London, he's well-established as an actor, but he's also, like the people on Saturday Night Live, apart from his acting, he's writing script material for himself to act. And that's William Shakespeare. And he, like others, I think, of his time, but he's the great dramatist of that time, I think we will all credit that judgment, he's preoccupied in many of his plays with the nature of kingship, with the connection of the royal to the godly. And he's certainly also commenting on the politics of the time. I suppose the most barely conceivable crime is to kill God's agent, to take a king and pull him off his throne and then kill him. That was done in the year 1399 to Richard II. It was done by Henry Bolingbroke, who led a rebellion and who then appointed himself King of England, and he was Henry IV, father of Laurence Olivier, as Henry
V.
Here, I want you to hear a scene, and then I want to get your commentary on it. I will ask you to think about how this relates to actual Elizabethan politics, even though it has reference to the days before the assassination of Richard II. He's now held in a castle prison He has already been unseated by Bolingbroke, and he's that's another scene. He's just returned from Ireland, where he's been at war, and he gets news that Bolingbroke is coming down upon him with a very, very powerful army. And as represented by John Gielgud, here is his response.
Pushy, Green, and the Earl of Wiltshire dead?
Aye. All of them at Bristol lost their heads.
Where is the Duke, my father, with his power?
No matter where. Of comfort, no man speak. Let's talk of graves, of worms and epitaphs. Make dust our paper and with rainy eyes write sorrow on the bosom of the earth. Let's choose executors and talk of wills. And yet not so, for what can we bequeath save our deposed bodies to the ground? Our lands, our lives, and all are Bolingbroke's. And nothing can we call our own save death. And that small model of the barren earth which serves as paste and cover to our bones. For God's sake, let us sit upon the ground and tell sad stories of the death of kings, how some have been deposed, some slain in war, some haunted by the ghosts they have deposed, some poisoned by their wives, some sleeping killed, all murdered. For within the hollow crown that rounds the mortal temples of a king keeps death his court. And there the antic sits, scoffing his state and grinning at his pomp, allowing him a breath, a little scene, to monarchize, be feared, and kill with looks, infusing him with self and vain conceit, as if this flesh which walls about our life were brass impregnable. And humored thus, comes at the last, and with a little pin, bores through his castle wall, and farewell, King. Cover your heads, and mock not flesh and blood with solemn reverence. Throw away respect, tradition, form, and ceremonious duty. For you have but mistook me all this while. I live with bread, like you, feel want, taste grief, need friends. Subjected thus, how can you say to me, I am a king?
Now then, what did Shakespeare have in mind as he wrote that with regard to the current or recent political events? What did his audience know that we don't easily or quickly know, except that you do?
Well, of course, they would have known a bit of the history of the Tudors, and that the Tudors would not have been on the throne if not for the events that began in 1399. There's that. They knew the history of the plots against Elizabeth. They didn't know that just 5 years later, 5 or 6 years later, the Earl of Essex would have this play put on just before an attempt at the throne himself, Essex's rebellion in the spring of 1601, in the late winter of 1601, and that Elizabeth, the story goes that when she saw the play, she turns to the courtiers around her and says, "Know you not that I am Richard II? Any king watching this play must have found it a very, very disturbing and uncomfortable experience."
And in fact, a historian wrote a history of Henry IV and dedicated it to the Earl of Essex, and Elizabeth was so angry about that that the historian was actually put in the Tower for a bit. Richard II was a very frightening example, and there's an idea that the king, in a sense, had two bodies, or the queen had two bodies, the body that did, like everyone else, get cold, get hungry, need to eat bread, but also the body that was the special body of the monarch and that was different from everyone else. And so there was this whole question, what about the queen's two bodies? And would her body politic continue, or would her body natural somehow lose its life?
Now here's another reflection by Shakespeare on the nature of kingship and the difference between the royal front you put up and the reality of being a king. It's as if you're confessing that the whole show is a fake, but you've got to maintain the fake. I refer to the soliloquy from Henry V. This, I believe, is before the Battle of Agincourt.
Yes,
and
it is.
Henry is wandering among his troops in the middle of the night, and some challenge him, not knowing that he is the king. And they speak with some doubt about the king's worthiness. And Henry then muses about his kingship.
Upon the king. Let us our lives, our souls, our debts, our careful wives, our children, and our sins lay on the king. We must bear all. Oh, hard condition, twin-born with greatness, subject to the breath of every fool, whose sense no more can feel but his own ringing. What infinite heart's ease must kings neglect that private men enjoy? And what have kings that privates have not too, save ceremony? Save general ceremony. And what art thou, thou idle ceremony? What kind of god art thou that sufferest more of mortal griefs than do thy worshippers? What are thy rents? What are thy comings in? O ceremony, show me but thy worth. What is thy soul of adoration? Art thou aught else but place, degree, and form, creating awe and fear in other men, wherein thou art less happy being feared than they in fearing? What drink'st thou oft instead of homage sweet, but poisoned flattery? Oh, be sick, great greatness, and bid thy ceremony give thee cure. Think'st thou the fiery fever will go out with titles blown from adulation? Will it give place to flexure and low bending? Canst thou, when thou command'st the beggar's knee, command the health of it? No, thou proud dream, that playst so subtly with a king's repose. I am a king that find thee, and I know 'tis not the balm, the scepter, and the ball, the sword, the mace, the crown imperial, the intertissued robe of gold and pearl, the farcied title running for the king, the throne he sits on, nor the tide of pomp that beats upon the high shore of this world. No, not all these, thrice gorgeous ceremony, not all these, laid in bed majestical, can sleep so soundly as the wretched slave, who, with a body filled and vacant mind, gets into rest, crammed with distressful bread. Never sees horrid night the child of hell, but like a lackey from the rise to set, sweats in the eye of Phoebus, and all night sleeps in Elysium. Next day after dawn doth rise and help Hyperion to his horse, and follows so the ever-running year with profitable labor to his grave. And but for ceremony, such a wretch, winding up days with toil and nights with sleep, had the forehand and vantage of a king. The slave, a member of the country's peace, enjoys it, but in gross brain little wots what watch the king keeps to maintain the peace, whose hours the peasant best advantages.
What an exceptional speech.
It is an exceptional speech. And another thing that Shakespeare has his Henry V say that night is that he has reburied Richard II and given his body all honor. One of the things that Elizabeth said was that if she was ever turned out in her petticoat, she would be able to survive well. So Elizabeth was well aware of life for the people as well as for the monarch, just as Shakespeare's Henry V is very well aware of that too.
Is Shakespeare saying royalty is just a great charade, we see through it?
I think on some level he's saying that, and of course there's your modernity right there, to see mm-hmm. ceremony. I think this is how we as moderns tend to see ceremony, as being mere empty show.
That's why the events at Buckingham Palace seem to us rather ludicrous.
Well, yes, but on the other hand, we do seem to have this human need for show. We do want mm-hmm. our presidents to look presidential. Mm-hmm. We do want, you know, we also flock to the gates of Buckingham Palace to watch this stuff. And if you remember, for example, the funeral of Princess Diana,
yeah.
I mean, there was a sense that Buckingham Palace had to do right by her by putting on a tremendous show. The other thing about it is, imagine what it must have been to be Elizabeth in the 1590s. I mean, for me, this speech captures all the sort of emptiness of being alone. It's lonely
exactly
at the top,
so.
Right? Could she have had
yeah.
any friends? She must have known that every time she walked out into the courtyard of Whitehall Palace or wherever, somebody could have stuck a knife in. There was no bosom companion to share her most intimate secrets. And it must have been a tremendous burden.
But she had ceremony.
Yes.
But obviously it wasn't a great consolation to her. Or maybe it was. We don't know.
Well, she was good at it. So she certainly, at the very least,
she played the role
well. She recognized
its
importance.
Yeah.
She did play the role well. And while I think, yes, the 1590s were hard for her, William Cecil, who had been her principal secretary, her Lord Treasurer, died in 1598. And I think his death, the death of Sir Francis Walsingham in 1590, the death of Robert Dudley, the Earl of Leicester, her closest companion in 1588, those were very hard for her.
We are late for some commercials, and that's because I'm so fascinated by this whole conversation and by your brilliant contributions to it. But we pause for those messages and we'll shortly return to Carol Levin and Robert Buchholz. The period we are talking about tonight, the Elizabethan Age, has been heavily researched, and there's a great deal of scholarly work on it, and two of the leading scholars are, in fact, our guests tonight. And I should say a word about their most recent books. Carol Levin, this very year, has published two books, one titled High and Mighty Queens of Early Modern England, Realities and Representations. You have some Well, actually, you're the editor.
That's correct.
A co-editor of that book, a number of contributors, and then fully written by Carol Levin, The Reign of Elizabeth I. Both of these are published by Palgrave. And Robert Buchholz, together with a colleague, Newton Key, has done a major historical narrative titled Early Modern England, 1485 to 1714. So Elizabeth is smack in the middle of it,
that's
more
right.
or less, but
that's
we
right.
start
She's
earlier.
Everything. It starts with the end of the Wars of the Roses and the establishment of the Tudor regime by Henry VII, Elizabeth's grandfather, and then it continues with the Stuarts in the 17th century, who mm-hmm. basically had to solve all the problems really created by Elizabeth's dad, Henry VIII, and that Elizabeth
You think
was
all
so
the blame
good.
Goes back to Big Henry?
Yeah, I really do. I think that if you look at the English Civil War of the mid-17th century and the Glorious Revolution at the end, the issues around which it revolved were religion. Well, it was obviously Henry who initiated that debate. Royal finances, it was Henry who bankrupted the crown, fighting French wars that England did not need to fight. The role of the king and the role of Parliament, it was Henry who brought Parliament into the debate on religion and therefore gave them something other than money to talk about. Every big problem faced by England in the 17th century can be traced back to the reign of this titanic yeah. individual.
He was a big king indeed.
It's worth remembering that the killing of kings, regicide, doesn't end with the killing of Richard II, about which we spoke earlier, but rather some time after Elizabeth's reign, the English managed to kill another king.
Absolutely, and I think one of the reasons that Elizabeth was so ambivalent and so really in torment over whether to have Mary Stuart executed was, yes, English kings had been killed before, Richard II and Edward II, but they'd been forced to abdicate and then had been murdered secretly. Mary was actually put on trial, found guilty, and publicly executed. And in fact, there is a sketch of Mary's execution that was made by a member of the Privy Council, and it is on loan from the British Library to the Newbury Library, and people can see it if they come to the exhibit. Elizabeth thought this was a terrible, terrible precedent to actually have a queen executed, and she was right, because it was Mary Stuart's grandson, Charles I, who was executed January 30th, 1649. And for Charles's execution, this, I think, really changed English history to have the public execution of a king.
It's the moment when it could be argued England really crosses the line into the consideration of constitutional monarchy. Once you kill the king, and remember, unlike Richard II, unlike previous monarchs, and here the president of Mary Queen of Scots is really important, they did it in full public view. They had a trial in Parliament.
They set a precedent, and obviously that precedent must have made it all the easier many years later to do a public trial and a public execution of the King of France.
Exactly right. I mean, when looking for precedents, they look to this. If I may, I can read a description of this event, not the execution, but the trial. The spectacle must have been impressive. Of Charles I in 1649. The spectacle must have been impressive. The largest medieval hall in England, packed to the rafters with spectators. At its south end, on several tiers of red velvet benches, underneath not the royal arms, but those of England, sat the commissioners, assorted army officers, MPs, and gentlemen, presided over by a heretofore obscure judge, John Bradshaw. Before them sat an array of lawyers and clerks, all in black. At the north end and in the upper galleries, crowds of spectators, held back by wooden rails and soldiers in their red coats. On the other side of a hastily constructed wooden partition, in a makeshift dock in the middle of the hall, sat the magnetic object of all eyes, a solitary figure in black, but for the brilliant blue and silver of the star and garter. The King of England. What a remarkable moment to take a king and say, we're not going to murder you in the alley. We are going to charge you with treason. Not against yourself, because up to this point, treason had always been against the king. Treason against the people of England.
This was a redefining of what treason meant. And by saying treason was not against an act against the king, but an act against the people, that meant the King of England himself could be found guilty of treason. The irony is that we feel very sorry for Charles, alone, about all these people against him, and yet it was the execution of the king that did lead eventually to a constitutional monarchy.
That's right. But high costs are paid for progress, if progress indeed occurs. It's clear that in material terms, England progressed. It's clear that it became the leading nation in the world in a few more hundred years. It was indeed the leading nation in the world in terms of power and extension in the 19th century.
Indeed. The sun never set on the English Empire, and that may be because nobody could trust them in the dark.
But you're doing that now in the past tense. Well, you used to say the sun never sets, but now you're doing it in the past tense.
In the past tense, yes.
I suppose it doesn't set on the Commonwealth, and of course the Commonwealth has been in the news of late, so we're still living with the legacy of this empire. And here, I think I can throw in a plug for England's other great queen, Queen Anne, because it was, of course...
She's your queen.
She's my queen. She's the one I work on. It was Elizabeth's last Stuart
successor. Explain to some of our listeners just where Queen Anne is located.
Queen Anne is the last of the Stuarts. She rules from 1702 to 1714, so she's 100 years after Elizabeth. And it must be said that without Elizabeth, showing that a woman could rule England effectively, because remember, it can't be argued that Mary Tudor had actually shown that. It could be argued that Anne would never have come to the throne. She's the youngest daughter of James II, who was deposed in 1688 for being a Catholic, but also pursuing Catholic policies. And Anne presides over a war, the War of the Spanish Succession, in which Louis XIV is humiliated, in which England acquires a vast overseas empire, little bits of land of no apparent strategic importance like Gibraltar, which allows you to control the Mediterranean, St. Kitts in the Caribbean, which allows you to control the sugar trade, which would be the major trade of the 18th century. It must also be said that as a result of this war, England acquires a major share of the North American and South American slave trade, which is very much a blot on the reputation of the Stuarts and English in the 18th century.
That brings to mind something of great interest as a minor chapter of Elizabethan history, and that is the cultural diversity that begins to show up.
There certainly was cultural diversity in Elizabethan England.
There were Jews and blacks.
Yes, there were. There's a wonderful book by Jim Shapiro called Shakespeare and the Jews.
We discussed it on this program some years ago with Shapiro.
It's an amazing book, and Professor Shapiro said that he read a book called The Reign of Elizabeth I, and there was no mention of Jews. And so when I wrote my book, The Reign of Elizabeth I, I was convinced there would be mention of Jews. Yes, there were Jewish communities, there were people from the Middle East, there were Africans, some of whom were brought as captives to England and also to Scotland in the 16th century. So while we think of England as kind of monolithic, in fact, it was a multicultural world in the reign of Elizabeth. It's the beginning, but it's certainly an important beginning.
Michael Wood was here recently, a British quasi-academic who's a BBC presenter, yes, and has done a major series on Shakespeare. And we talked about that. He's done an accompanying book on that. And our conversation turned to Amelia
Lenier.
Well, Bassanio.
Bassanio was her maiden name.
Yeah.
And the Bassanios were, in fact, Italian Jewish musicians.
Exactly.
Henry VIII wanted a really glorious court, and so Thomas Cromwell, his principal secretary in the 1530s, said, well, let's bring in the best musicians. Who are they and where are they? And in fact, they were Jewish musicians and instrument makers from Italy who came, and in fact, yes, Amelia Bassanio Lanier was descended from them.
And it is A.L. Rouse's hypothesis, as you know, and I think he makes a fairly good case for it, as does Michael Wood think, that Rouse essentially is right, that Amelia Lanier was the dark lady of the sonnets for Shakespeare, and thus was Shakespeare's mistress.
This may be the case. We don't know who the dark lady was, but she was certainly a fascinating...
You don't find Rouse's demonstration convincing?
I actually don't find it convincing. It may be true, but I don't think that the evidence convinces me. But what I think is more important is that we have this amazing woman who was herself a poet, was a strong-minded person, and mm-hmm. was... though she herself was a Christian, she was descended of Jews, and there was the Italian Jewish community. There was also a very strong Sephardic Jewish community from the Iberian Peninsula. And in fact, Elizabeth's own physician in the 1590s was Roderico Lopez. And while he outwardly was an Anglican, many thought that he was secretly a Jew, and there were secret Jewish communities. Lopez, unfortunately, was executed in large part because of the Earl of Essex, who Bob mentioned earlier. And Essex wanted to show Elizabeth that he could protect her from spies just as Walsingham had, and so accused Lopez of planning to poison Elizabeth, even though probably Lopez was not guilty.
Would it be fair to say, returning again to the question of counterfactuals, that if you didn't have Elizabeth and her reign, England would not have risen to be the major power it was, and would not have progressed into the industrial era the way it did, and so on?
Quite possibly. I mean, again, counterfactuals are very difficult, but if you don't have a Protestant Elizabeth, if England is forever in the shadow of Spain...
You know,
France,
you are a Weberian in that regard, then.
Yeah.
You argue that, as Max Weber does in The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism, that Protestantism is a base for the erection of capitalistic institutions.
No, I don't believe that. But what I believe is that Protestantism gives England identity, and it gives England a separateness from the continent in a way mm-hmm. that had not been true before. England
yeah.
is a different species of Christendom after 1558. And notice, a unique one. It's not entirely Protestant either. The Church of England is a wonderful, I think a miraculous compromise.
Sometimes called Anglo-Catholic, of course.
But as English people define themselves as being different from French people and different from Spanish people, and in particular, precisely because of this religious difference, that puts them into situations, military situations, diplomatic situations, and eventually economic situations in terms of trying to go to the New World and wrest bits of it from Spain. Now that will lead to a commercial revolution, and that will lead to the growth of English trade, and that will lead to full coffers in London, and that will lead to the Industrial Revolution without ever having to stop at the Max Weber station along the line.
But look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. Nothing lasts. Great
That's
empires
right.
fall. One might well ask, what remains of the Elizabethan spirit and the Elizabethan optimism in contemporary English life? I might well persist with that question after we pause for these words. By way of introducing or adding on to the question I was raising a moment ago, I want to go to one other Shakespearean scene. The question is, what has England become? And how did the English of the Elizabethan time really perceive the whatever was special about their place? How well favored did they find themselves to be occupying the England of Elizabeth? And for that, a great Elizabethan speech that is written by an Elizabethan, by none other than Shakespeare, again and again from the play Richard II. You remember it early in the play when Richard's uncle, John of Gaunt, old John of Gaunt, is dying, and he gets off a great soliloquy. One of the interesting things about it is it has just about the longest sentence in Shakespeare before you reach the period. And in it, he's giving a vision of how preferred a land England is, how God has smiled upon it and created a uniquely favored place. And I wonder if this is representative of how the Elizabethans thought of themselves and of their place. And I wonder to what degree this persists in English consciousness. Here is the famous This England speech of John of Gaunt.
This earth, this realm, this England, this nurse, this teeming womb of royal kings, feared by their breed and famous by their birth, renowned for their deeds as far from home for Christian service and true chivalry as is the sepulchre in stubborn Jewry of the world's ransom, blessed Mary's son. This land of such dear souls, this dear, dear land, dear for her reputation through the world, is now leased out. I die pronouncing it like to a tenement or pelting farm. England bound in with a triumphant sea whose rocky shore beats back the envious siege of watery Neptune is now bound in with shame, with inky blots and rotten parchment bonds. That England that was wont to conquer others hath made a shameful conquest of itself. Oh, would the scandal vanish with my life? How happy then were my ensuing death.
That's a famous speech. And what he's telling us there is England was a great place once. We have all the conditions for its being the supreme location in the world. But Richard has kind of screwed it up.
Yeah. In some ways, sure, that's still there. I mean, we're all very, anyone who works in British history is very careful. You go to endless dinner parties and hear the Queen and royal family criticized, and you soon learn that if you're not a subject born, best not to join in. But there is a sense that London is still one of the world's great publishing capitals. English people have gone out into the world. Our universities have been enriched. Our medical centers have been enriched. The British really have.
But the medical centers are enriched now by people who used to be colonial in their relation to England, namely by Indian doctors.
So that, of course, goes back to this legacy of empire.
Yes, which, it does.
So it you know, the ripple effect is still out there. The most famous part of the speech, which comes afterwards, is the notion of England being a fortress against infection and the hand of war, this earth of majesty, this seat of Mars. And I think there may still be that perception of England being the English race being an island people and England, the channel being a barricade. But of course, the reality is that England was populated by successive waves of invaders. The English are themselves, they are Celts, and they are Romans, and they are Anglo-Saxons, and they are Normans, and they are Dutch, and they are French. The reality is the language itself, this great language we have, is a combination of all of those different...
A Shakespearean scholar that I know once pointed out that very speech that we're listening to, if it had been delivered by John of Gaunt, would have been delivered in French. Rather than
incomprehensible
anything like English
to Shakespeare's audience. But then, yeah. On the other hand, Shakespeare's audience was very xenophobic. This is the sense we have of London crowds. There were always riots against the Spanish ambassadors. Carriage was pulled aside very often. So, yes, in a sense, Shakespeare is catering to his audience. He's telling them what they want to hear. The reality is it's much more complicated than that. England is much more, in some ways, much more like the modern United States in terms of being a mixture of peoples and cultures and influences.
But the sun now does set on the empire. The empire no longer exists. And they are you won't say this to the face of any of your friends at a London dinner party, but they are a second-rate nation now, aren't they?
Well, politically, they don't have the power that they once had, but culturally, certainly, they are still very important. The work of Shakespeare, which clearly you love as well as I, is still being performed not only in London, but in fact all over the world. And that impact is one that is enduring. Elizabeth herself was not only loved during her time, but is certainly one of the most famous monarchs who has ever lived.
Look about you. The banner's on Michigan Avenue. Elizabeth has taken the city of Chicago by storm.
We should now, in fact, go to the Newbery and to that great exhibit in which Carol played a, in whose construction Carol played a major role. You enter the Newbery, and what do you see?
The exhibit is amazing. You enter and you see a beautiful, enormous portrait of Elizabeth I.
Is it the one that you're wearing at the moment?
No, this is the coronation portrait. But the portrait that you see when you enter, she is all in black. It's done about 1580. She is very self-assured, and she is holding in her hand a sieve. And the sieve represents her virginity, because by 1580, it's clear she's not going to marry, and she is presenting herself as the virgin queen, the kind of bring people through losing the Virgin Mary, because we're now Protestants.
Perhaps we should explain the mythology of
that. How does the sieve represent virginity?
I was hoping you would ask that. Elizabeth, of course, knew very well the classics. She was highly educated. And in classical mythology, a Vestal virgin, and thus was accused of not being a virgin, she would have been killed. The virgin went down to the river, filled a sieve, and a sieve is, of course, like a colander. She filled it with water, carried it back to her judges, and not a drop was spilt. Well, luckily, Elizabeth didn't try that. Even though we do think she probably was a virgin, it's still good she didn't try that.
How this but proves she, virginity, I'm at a loss. But
she certainly presented herself as the Virgin Queen, and it's a beautiful way to enter the exhibit. The beginning of the exhibit shows Elizabeth before she becomes queen. Bob mentioned earlier the amazing manuscript where the S has been added because she's a princess, not a prince. We even have a letter in her own handwriting written when she was only 15 years old. It's very beautiful handwriting. She has been accused of having an affair with Thomas Seymour, the uncle of the king. Her servants are in the tower. Seymour is in the tower. And she, at 15, defends herself beautifully. When she becomes queen, there are tremendous arguments against a woman ruling. John Knox, the Calvinist, wrote what he called the first blast of the trumpet against the monstrous regiment of women. He thought it was going to be the first blast of many. It turned out to be the first and the last.
He meant it against Mary, but of course, he made the mistake of publishing it in the year of Mary's death, 1558, so it looked like it was meant against Elizabeth.
And Elizabeth never forgave him. We have the first blast of the trumpet there. We also have an amazing manuscript written by Henry Howard. This has never been published, and he took 12 years to write to get Elizabeth's approval of why women should rule. You also have in the exhibit, you have manuscripts, you have many books, you have a beautiful carved chair that belonged to the Earl of Arundel. You have the execution picture of Mary Stuart. The Newbery Library is known for its beautiful maps, and there are amazing maps in this exhibit, including one that was made for Mary and her older sister. And it's an amazing map, but one part of it has been defaced, and that's because it had the coat of arms not only of England, but also Spain. And legend tells us when Elizabeth inherited it, she just scraped out those arms of Spain.
And that's the sort of thing she might do.
I believe it.
This You're both quite fond of her, aren't you?
We're very fond of Elizabeth.
I begin to get that sense.
I think she was absolutely extraordinary.
She's real to you. She's not a distant figure, apparently.
This woman is very real to me, and I think she's real to many, many people. We've had little girls come to the exhibit and just love Elizabeth. One child came and she was studying the portraits because she told us, this was prior to Halloween, she was going to be Elizabeth for Halloween. I thought that was just wonderful.
I'm not sure if I like her. I don't know that I'd like to come to dinner with her. There's a famous story of her stabbing somebody's hand with a fork when they told her something she didn't want to hear. But I admire her tremendously. Her achievement is to survive in a world which could, at any number of points, could very easily have swallowed her up and killed her and destroyed her kingdom, and she did it. And as we've said tonight, so much that happened, for good or ill, following her reign is because she had the skills to do that, a consummate politician. And for that reason, someone that even after years of study, I'm not quite sure that I know. I think that we could continue this discussion all night and for years to come and still perhaps not quite pin down this enigmatic woman, and so a source of endless fascination.
Absolutely. Elizabeth, we know what she said, but we don't know what she thought. Elizabeth was brilliant at her self-presentation and incredibly cautious about sharing what she thought. There are some moments when I think we do have the real Elizabeth. One amazing moment was among her many, many, many courtships. One was with the Archduke Charles. He was the brother of the Holy Roman Emperor. And Elizabeth kept saying, oh, I would love to marry Charles, if only, but there we have to get things settled. Well, once she was walking with the imperial ambassador, the ambassador representing Charles, and also with the Spanish ambassador. And the Spanish ambassador knew her rather better. And the imperial ambassador is believing all of this. And Elizabeth is wearing a beautiful ruby ring. And so while she keeps saying, I'm longing for Charles, he says, well, why don't you give me the ring? I'll send it to him. And now Elizabeth, as she herself once put it, liked to take with both hands and give with her little finger. So she said, oh, no, no, no. But if we only can solve all these problems, Charles can come and he'll get the ring and me and everything. Now, the Spanish ambassador knew that Elizabeth didn't quite mean it. So he decided to tease her. And he said, how do you know you're not entertaining somebody who's more important than you think, i.e. suggesting that Charles had come in disguise? The ambassador says, Elizabeth turned white. She almost fainted. She was so upset at the thought that this man might have actually come and closed off her chance of saying she wanted to get married, but not actually marrying. So that's one moment where I think we see the actual Elizabeth.
Well, we are due for some commercials, and it is time to open the phone lines. Any question you'd like to raise about Queen Elizabeth, about the Elizabethan age, or about British history since then, 591-7200 is the number. 591-7200. And the area code, of course, 312 if you're calling long distance. If you're at a great long distance and listening to us on the internet in another country or on either coast, or I think, Robert, you said some friends of yours in London are supposed to be staying up tonight to hear this thing.
Possibly. I'm expecting the entire publishing team at Blackwell Publishing to be listening to this.
Now, well, they can reach us by phone if they choose, but they can also email us, the email address being extension720@tribune.com. Extension720 as one word at Tribune, TRIBUNE.com, or 591-7200. We return right after these words. And we return to Carol Levin, professor of history at the University of Nebraska, and to Robert Buchholz, professor of history at Loyola University here in Chicago. And we will be going almost instantly to the phones. The phone number again is 591-7200. And if you want to reach us via email, wherever you're located, the email address, extension720, one word, at tribune.com. And you are on the air. Good evening.
Good evening. I'm enjoying the show. I wanted to ask, what were the relative populations of Spain and England in 1588?
England in 1588 is roughly 2.5 to 3 million people. Spain, I'm going to have to take a wild guess here. France is something like 3 to 4 times the size. I would think that Spain would be closer to England, however. Now, that's not counting the empire.
I know that at the time of the French Revolution in 1789, the populations of Spain and England were supposedly equal at 9 million.
That sounds right to me. I think probably, I mean, Spain obviously is a bigger country, but people are more spread out, and Madrid doesn't compare to London in terms of population. There are other important cities in Spain. I'm going to go
the
same size.
At that time, Madrid was not the capital of Spain, you know.
Right.
Madrid became the capital of Spain, I think, in the 18th century.
Well, there's the whole issue of the Spanish monarchy and its kind of ramshackle structure. They're two very different countries. I think we tend to think of Spain as being highly centralized and absolutist, and Philip II's word went. But, of course, there were different ethnic traditions. It's rather more complicated than that.
Our thanks to the caller. Was Philip of Spain a serious suitor of Elizabeth as well?
Yes, he was. He, of course, had married her older sister, yeah. Mary I. But after Mary's death, he did suggest that he would marry Elizabeth, but of course she had to become Catholic, and she had to ask the Pope for a dispensation. Apparently, this actually made her laugh, according to some contemporaries, and she did not marry Philip, and Philip instead, for his third wife, married the daughter of Henry II of France instead.
But it is important to remember that for the first 10 years of Elizabeth's reign, Philip is her best friend. Philip is her protection against France. Philip wants a reasonably strong England to protect its holdings in the Netherlands. So it's important not to read 1588 back. The situation was always tense, but there were times when Elizabeth could look to Philip for a little bit of support.
So how did things fall apart?
Well, two reasons. One was Mary, Queen of Scots, and religion. But the other thing we haven't talked about all night was Drake and Hawkins and Frobisher and the attacks on the Spanish Empire. From Spain's point of view,
long before the Armada came at England, the privateers were going at
that's
Spain.
That's right. It starts in 1568 with a famous, essentially, I mean, we tend to glorify these guys. You know, Drake and Hawkins were freedom fighters. Well, if you stop and think about it, the first clash came in 1568, and they were slavers. They were trying to sell slaves to the Spanish New World. They wanted a cut of this trade. The Spanish didn't want to let them in. They eventually engaged in piracy. And
Sir Francis Drake, the famous bowler, was a slaver?
Yes, or at least he wanted to be, yeah. And indeed, I'll go farther and perhaps say something even more controversial. From Spain's point of view, Spain being the only superpower in the world at the time, England is a terrorist nation. They're supporting mm-hmm. Drake, Hawkins, Frobisher. They're looking the other way. What do Drake, Hawkins, and Frobisher do? They turn up at ports, mm-hmm. and they fire the ports. They destroy merchantmen, innocent people can die. And so from Spain's point of view, it looks rather different.
Except I would just add that Protestants in the Netherlands saw themselves also as
absolutely.
Freedom fighters, and they were going to Elizabeth and to these privateers for support against Philip, who was actually put, William the Silent, who was the head of the Netherlands, he put out a call for William's assassination. And so, in fact, while my wonderful colleague is correct that Drake was a slaver, he also called picking off Spanish ships as singeing the beard of his most Catholic Majesty.
We go back to the phones. Here's another caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello.
Yes, ma'am.
My question is about the avenues of communication and therefore the avenues of change in modern Elizabethan England. At the Newbery Symposium, the ballad was mentioned, and I wonder what else we might consider so that what happened at court, what happened in Parliament, filtered down in what ways to the people.
A lot of Elizabeth's speeches were published and then were sent out all through the country. Yes, there were ballads, the plays that we've been talking about, not only were played in London, but many of the plays then traveled around the country as well. There were what were called broadsides, which were very brief pamphlets, often just a sheet, and these would be published. So this is an excellent question, and I'm glad you were at the symposium. Many of the ideas spread much faster, and of course one reason is the printing press. And,
but we were also told that women could not read then.
Well, people read aloud. People read aloud much, much more than they did before. And women who could read aloud. We have many records of upper-class women reading to their servants, reading religious works, the works of John Fox, which was the great martyrology. We know that that was read aloud to many people. So even if women themselves, some women couldn't read, they did learn many, many things. Also, Fox's Acts and Monuments and was incredibly popular. It was available in almost every church, and it was highly, highly illustrated, so that even if you couldn't read, you could basically follow the stories. The illustrations are amazing, pretty horrifying, but very, very powerful.
Thank you, ma'am, for the call.
Thank you.
We're glad to have heard from you, and we go quickly to another. Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, I have a question dealing with Queen Anne, mostly.
Oh, boy.
Do you think that it hurts her historical image that she embraced a more feminine nature, unlike Elizabeth, who embraced a more masculine nature, the whole heart and stomach and all that?
Well, thank you. This actually plays into one of my sort of pet theories. I think one of the reasons we love Elizabeth is that male historians have always celebrated her for what? Her courage, her sharp tongue, her imperious nature. These are stereotypical male traits, according to the way males were constructed at the time, and it could be argued through the 20th century. All of Anne's virtues were on the order of being sober, quiet, loyal to her husband, attempted to be a good mother. As you may know, she was pregnant 18 times and yet unable to produce a child that survived her. And so instead of becoming the virgin queen, which she could not be, she became the mother of her people. And I think one of the reasons we sell Anne short is that these are values stereotypically associated with women. And so it's part of our tendency, or what has been a tendency in our society for several thousand years, to sell women and their abilities and their qualities short. And so I'm trying to lead a small charge to sort of revive Anne and remind people that a good mother of the nation is also of great use. And so thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And we thank you, sir. It's interesting, it just occurs to me, there's quite a number of British queens who follow. William and Mary reign jointly, and Mary is a queen. And then there is Queen Anne, and there is, of course, Queen Victoria. Who has a reign virtually as longer as it was.
It's even longer than Elizabeth.
Than Elizabeth.
Yes.
And there is Elizabeth II.
And it could be argued that they are all successful, apart from Mary Tudor. They're all very successful, and they're all exactly what the country needed at that particular moment in history. So the sort of anti-feminist argument about leadership and rulership ought to have been effectively killed, I would argue, by 1603, certainly by 1901 after Queen Victoria.
And England was the first major country to have a political head of state who was female.
Yes, they were, though.
I'm wrong. India had a prime minister who was female before England did.
Oh, you mean before Margaret Thatcher?
Before Thatcher, yeah.
Yes.
And of course, there are people like Eleanor of Aquitaine and going way back. But it is true. I mean, remember that in 1740, Europe goes to war over Maria Theresa becoming the Emperor of Austria. And it always struck me that from an English context, this is absurd. Frederick the Great thinks that Maria Theresa cannot rule the Austrian Empire, and therefore he invades. Well, if he had read his English history, he would know that he was going to be in for it. And in fact, he was over the course of a series of wars.
We have a last batch of commercials that are due, and then we will return. Batch of commercials that is due. Batch is singular. The commercials are plural. And we return right after this. And with regard to our audio archive, a very special note. I was moved and saddened today, as were thousands of other people who knew him, to learn of the death of Paul Simon. Paul Simon was here on this program only a month ago, precisely on the date of November 6th. He joined us for a full two-hour conversation together with Joe Morris. We are rushing to put that up on our audio archive, and it has now been prepared for the archive. It will be up tomorrow. If you want to hear that program, if you missed it, or if you want to hear it again, you can find that at the Extension 720 Audio Archive. Also, just recently placed there is our conversation with William Ian Miller, a professor of law at the University of Michigan, who's got a wonderful book titled Faking It, about how we fake just about everything in life. And Charles Murray, a major sociologist, who's done a book about the nature of human accomplishment. Those are up already. The Simon program will be up by midday tomorrow. And with that, we Go back to the phones, 591-7200, and you are on the air. Good evening.
Hello.
Yes.
I was wondering, I had read Margaret George's novel, and I realize it's a novel, of Mary Queen of Scots, and I thought it was a really interesting perspective of the relationship between Mary and Elizabeth. And I was wondering, you know, with all of their knowledge, how accurate they really felt that portrayal was of Elizabeth.
I'm afraid we are going to disappoint you. One of the things I think we have to do to acquire this knowledge is avoid historical novels. I don't know about Carol, but I'm scared to death that I'll pick something up that isn't in the evidence. And so I look forward to retirement when I will plunge in to what is undoubtedly, in my understanding, some of the best literature being produced today.
Or maybe you'll write one.
Yeah, if I need the money.
Yeah.
I'm afraid I haven't read it either, so I'm afraid I can't.
So you tell us.
Yeah, what's the take?
Well, really, it deals with how Mary, the intrigue, basically, what brought Mary to the throne, all of the things that happened occurring with her father's death, and then her mother becoming regent, and she being raised as a Catholic in France, and then having to come back and be the leader of a Protestant nation who really did not care for her, and then having herself being, you know, relative of Elizabeth, such a close relative, and then having them never have really met.
No, the two never did
correspond. Yeah, and having them correspond over the years, and supposedly Elizabeth had sent Mary a ring and said, if you ever need me, if you ever need my help, please send the ring back to me. And she looked to Elizabeth, of course, for help when everything was crumbling around her. She made a lot of very bad choices.
Mary did make bad choices.
Yeah, horrible, horrible choices. Surrounding herself with some people who did not have her best interest at heart.
When Mary fled Scotland for England, on the one hand, she asked Elizabeth for help, but on the other hand, she sent word to the Spanish ambassador and said, if your master will help me, I'll be Queen of England in 6 months, and mass will be said all over the country. So
right.
Mary
exactly.
did not
she played
support
both
her.
Sides.
Ma'am, I feel we have to move
well,
on. Thank you very much for the call, and we will go quickly to another. 591-7200, the number. You are on the air. Good evening.
Yeah, Milt, wondering what Elizabeth looked like. Was she a good-looking woman, small, large, or what?
That's a fine question.
Well, Elizabeth would claim that she was great-looking. Early in her reign, she met the Scottish ambassador, and she tried to get him to say who was better-looking, she or Mary, Queen of Scots, and he, being a great diplomat, said that she was the most beautiful queen of England, and Mary was the most beautiful queen of Scotland. She then asked who was taller, and he said, well, my queen is taller. So Elizabeth said, then she's too tall because I am the perfect height. She had auburn hair like her father. She was very thin. She had very dark eyes like her mother. She had a very thin aquiline nose. She apparently was very attractive in her youth, and in fact, the Spanish ambassador under her sister Mary described Elizabeth as being a spirit filled with enchantment. If you go to the Newbery Library and go to the exhibit, there are several quite beautiful portraits of Elizabeth that you can look at.
Of course, one of the points that we want to make in relation to this and another question is that Elizabeth controlled her image very carefully, and then after about the 1580s was not real happy with being depicted perhaps as she was aging. And so there, the Privy Council was instructed to watch the images of the Queen. So unlike, say, Elizabeth Taylor in our own society, she's forever in our memory as a young woman.
No, but isn't there also an image of her plastered with white powder as an old woman?
Elizabeth did wear makeup in her old age, and she also wore a wig when her hair had turned
mm-hmm.
gray. And I think that getting old was probably yeah. hard for her, as it is for many women. So,
but that's a verbal image. I mean, she was very careful about who saw this and who didn't see it.
What was her age at death?
She was 69 years old.
69. We will work in one or two more quick calls, and here is the next. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello, Milt, how are you?
Fine, sir.
First of all, I want to say, great show, as always. I came in a little late to the show, so I'm not sure if I, whatever foundation was laid, but your female guest had said that Drake was a slaver, Although I believe, like,
actually,
just a minute before, your male guest had said there's not a basis for that per se. Not that, you know, there's any evidence that he was against that, but
no, we're reversed. I think I claim that he wanted to be, that part of that 1568 expedition in which Elizabeth did invest was, it was an attempt to be a
But apart from questions of priority, obviously the caller wants to know what's the truth.
Well, I would suggest that while he was certainly did pick off treasure ships and also slave ships, he also saw himself as a highly patriotic Englishman in fighting against Catholic Spain.
Sure, absolutely.
And we thank that caller, and we'll go directly to another on 591-7200. Good evening, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. You alluded earlier to Guy Fawkes, a conspirator in the gunpowder plot. I've just finished reading, speaking of great literature, the Patrick O'Brien, Aubrey Matron series, Master and Commander and so forth, and there's repeated references throughout the series to Guy Fawkes Knight.
Oh, yeah.
And the only thing that I could gather was a certain profligacy of explosion.
Oh, yes.
Could you tell me a little bit about Guy Fawkes Knight?
Sure. Very soon after, the call went out in sermons and in popular literature, remember the 5th of November. The 5th of November became a sort of English 4th of July, and to this day, Guy Fawkes and sometimes the Pope are burned in effigy on the 5th. Until recently, Halloween wasn't such a big holiday in Britain. It was Guy Fawkes Night was the great kind of harvest festival, you know, winter is coming on. The anti-Catholic dimension of it has diminished, but even in the 17th century, Gunpowder Treason Day was popularly celebrated. There was bell ringing, sermons, you had to go to church.
And also, I think that's very interesting and very English that they celebrated something that did not occur.
Yes. Well, it was God's deliverance of a Protestant people, the idea that God is an Englishman, and so he delivered England as he delivered England in 1588, as he was said to deliver England in 1688. These were all sort of self-fulfilling prophecies that convinced the English that they were indeed God's people.
Thank you, sir, for the call. A few minutes left. I should have posed this earlier, because I'm truly fascinated by this question, or rather the answers one gets to it. The nature of the craft of the historian. I wonder how you do it and do it well. And I know that there's a great deal of assiduous labor involved, and also a certain quality of imagination is called for, an empathic ability to somehow put yourself in that time and in that place. But what I also wonder, and I often ask this of historians, is do you ever wish that you could be there? If magically you could be transported to that time and left there, would you go?
No, I wouldn't. I love studying Elizabeth. I have a total passion for the Elizabethan period, but I think for a woman scholar, the very best time is the 21st century, and the very best place is the United States.
Same here. I'd like to go for maybe a day, maybe half a day, but remember, it stank and people died young.
When I once put this to somebody who studied England of the 18th century, his response was, good Lord, no, I love the place, but I wouldn't want to live there. It would be impossible. Remember, they didn't have dental anesthesia.
Or right and left shoes.
Oh?
Yeah, into the 18th century. All shoes were made to, yeah. You know, they were identical. So,
Is yours a very busy area of historical work that is particularly the Elizabethan period? Though I know that you both work beyond that period.
I think people, in a popular way, absolutely love Elizabeth I and want to learn about her and want to study her.
She is a heroine of history, in a way.
She really is.
Yeah, British history is booming on the popular level. In academic departments, it's not so popular. Our fellow historians don't necessarily want more of us around. But
well, they don't favor narrative history generally.
Well, there's that as well. But, of course, these great narratives lie at the heart of who we think we are. And mm-hmm. So it's very important to continue to do them and to pay attention to the work of historians who don't do narrative and incorporate that into the longer enterprise.
Coming up behind us shortly will be some music as we end. That is Peter Piers singing an Elizabethan song by Rossiter. I don't know quite who Rossiter was, do you?
He was a fairly minor figure at the Elizabethan court. Not as important as Dowland or Byrd.
But this is If She Forsake Me. And it reminds us that the Elizabethans were very interested in love.
Elizabethans were very interested in love, and so was Elizabeth I. Though she never married, one of her courtiers said she was greedy for marriage proposals. She wanted the whole world running after her.
Well, she is almost certainly Elizabeth.
We'll end on this tune. And with thanks to Carol Levin and Robert Buchholz for joining us this very evening. Tomorrow night, we look at the films of the year with Gene Phillips and Penelope Messick, two of our regular guests, and with J.R. Jones of the Chicago Reader. Until tomorrow at 9, thanks to all for listening and a cordial good night.
I do my love in light torment, but alas in vain. The costly gifts that I do send, she returns again. Thus still is my despair procured, and her malice more assured. Then come death and end my fame. Thus still is my despair procured, and her malice more assured. Thank you.